This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Nikki Patten is an advocate, a poet, a survivor. She grew up in a Black, Russian, Jewish, interracial family on the far south side of Chicago, and through her work has connected with Black women and girls experiencing violence. Now, part of her strategy has been creating spaces to uplift survivors' stories and experiences and sharing her own. Her new memoir, Working on Me, is out now, released during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which runs through the end of April. I sat down with her to learn more about her healing journey, and she starts with how it feels to have her memoir out in the world.
I'd say my number one emotion would be relief. I've been working on this book for 10 years. So I started writing this when I was pregnant with my son, when I first started grad school. He just turned 10 last summer.
Oh, wow.
So I think relief to have it be done and out. Yeah.
So I want to start with the title,
sure.
Working on Me, as I mentioned. Tell us more about what you're trying to convey with that.
Yeah, so I think that when you first read it, you might think like, ooh, self-help. But no, it's about kind of the forces that work on us that then require us to work on ourselves. To me, it's a dual title, and I'm not expecting anybody to get that just from reading it. But for me personally, when I thought about what to title this book, and we ran through several, there was just something that was the common thread. And that was that in all the time that I've been an artist, which is over 20 years now, that I've done organizing work, undergirding all of that is this desire to just, as Tony Campanbaro would say, you know, are you sure, sweetheart, that you want to be well? This desire to be well, to be better, to heal. And that just requires work. And so when I thought about it, I was like, oh, this is a book about working on me. This has been like what I've just done my whole life is work on me, which might sound selfish, but I also think that in some ways that's a big act of generosity, because the more I work on myself, the less that the ways that I'm able to harm works on other people.
And it's a memoir.
Yeah.
So you can be.
Yeah.
You're allowed.
Yes. Thank you, Sasha. Appreciate that.
In the author's note up the top, you write, quote, I've been written out of so many stories. I had to write my own. Say more on that.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I've been doing the work that I've been doing for a really long time. And there are certain narratives that we have about art in Chicago and who matters and who's relevant and who's not. And for me, especially being part of the early days of spoken word, a lot of like my peers and contemporaries, their names will get tossed out often as inspiration or teachers. And, you know, I was a part of that too, and have been sort of written out of some of that narrative, you know, and things that people now consider to be like, I think, you know, huge cultural landmarks like Wordplay, for example, at Young Chicago Authors. I named it that. Like I named it Wordplay. I was one of the, you know, first coordinators of that series.
Wow.
And so knowing that and knowing that for myself is important, but it's also important for me to like name it on paper. You know, Audre Lorde says, you know, if you're silent, you know, about your pain, they'll say that you enjoyed it, right? And so to me, it was important to sort of speak up and name myself in stories that maybe other people haven't named or didn't know to even name me. I don't even think it's a malicious thing. But I think that especially if you're a Black woman, if you're a Black person doing cultural work, it's very easy to be erased. It's very easy to just be cut out of the narrative. So we have to put ourselves back where we know where we belong.
Well, speaking of naming yourself, I mean, you weave in and out of third person narration throughout this book. Why'd you make that choice?
Yeah, so that was actually inspired by bell hooks. So I studied a lot of Black women and a lot of folks who write in the biomythography.
I thought I recognized
that. Yes, indeed. And she, you know, in her own memoir, she uses third person as a way to get at some of the deeper, like, emotional layers that she's trying to get to. And so for me, I didn't. that wasn't like a plan. It's just, it was an exercise for me. And then I just found over the years that there was something really comforting about writing in third person.
It clicks immediately though for the reader. Yeah. I was able to understand right away, oh, this is her.
Yeah.
She's talking about herself.
Yep. Yeah.
You don't shy away in this book from describing the verbal and the physical and the sexual violence.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised, Nikki, at the level of detail in some parts. Yeah. In your view, why do you think it's important for survivors to speak openly and honestly, even graphically, about their experiences?
Well, because I think a lot of times when we tell our stories as survivors, we're telling our stories for other people. Sometimes that can be for the police. Sometimes that can be for friends and family. But you're always thinking about how to put the narrative in a way that doesn't disturb people or doesn't upset people or shies away from like the detail because you don't want to make people uncomfortable. To your point, this is my memoir. And so I gave myself the permission to do that. Also because like, you know, frankly, I'm tired of repressing those parts of the story. I understand that it might make other people uncomfortable as it is to hear it or to read it, trust and believe like living it.
So when you say you're tired of repressing those parts, are you referring to having told these stories in the past and having to sort of disguise some parts or skip moments in history?
Yeah, I mean, I think just because there's not really any space to tell these stories, period. You know, like from the vantage point and for the healing and just even for the truth telling from the survivor, what are those spaces that exist like that? They really don't, you know? And so for me, yeah, I was like, I need one place where I can just say, this is what happened. And this is how I felt about what happened. And whether or not folks can resonate, whether or not they believe, whether or not they empathize, none of that is my business after it's on the page.
Yeah.
But for me, it was important to get it onto the page because if I didn't, I would be living with that inside of me for the rest of my life. And I just don't think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. You write about the ongoing nature of recovery, that it can be a lifelong journey. Yeah. I want to read a quote from your book here. This is from the passage Mama Marine. Mm. It says, quote, "These grooves in her brain, worn and torn by trauma, are full of meds in a house full of peace. And she's still sweaty, still terrified, still needing the escape of a bedroom that is hers." And this strikes me, Nikki, because I think people often have this idea, or maybe it's a desire, that trauma eventually goes away.
Yeah.
That's not quite the case, though.
No. Trauma and grief are flip sides of the same coin. And the truth about both of them is that they never go away. Like, you find better ways to cope. You hopefully recognize like the patterns that you use to cope, and hopefully you catch when those patterns are good and healthy for you so you can replicate that. And hopefully you catch when they're destructive and not so very good for you so you can stop doing that. But the trauma, the grief, it never goes away. And that's a big driver for writing this book, was just acknowledging that like for the rest of my life, yes, this is a part of my story. This is a part of like who I am. It doesn't define who I am. It doesn't have to continue to be my story, but it's an intrinsic part of who I am, and who I was before any of this, I can never be that person again. It just doesn't work out like that. That's what it means. Like, those things have worked on me, mm-hmm. and now there's a different version that's come out.
I love the multi-use of this title.
Yeah. I've been sitting with it for a minute now. Yeah.
You also write about growing up in the backyard of abandoned steel mills.
Yes.
And of many departures from and returns to Chicago.
Yeah.
So how has the Chicago area shaped you and maybe the way you write?
Sure. I mean, we are... You know, if you're from Chicago, like if you're from Chicago, not if you're born somewhere else and you move here, if you're from here, there's just a certain energy that you're born with. There's a certain level of rah-rah that we have, that we are just like with it, that we're about it, that like, if nothing else, like we are brave. We're some of the bravest people that I know. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that shaped me as a writer because I come from a place where no one pulls any punches. So how can I pull any punches with myself or with anyone else? So that's what you have on the page. You have me pulling no punches because I come from a place that literally has pulled no punches with me or anybody else that I know.
I know you've got listeners like, yes, right now.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
In the memoir, Nikki, you vividly describe the women in your family.
Yep.
Nana Jazzy, Pretty Mama, mm-hmm. Lil Baby.
Yep.
These nicknames. You write about their hardships and that effect on your self-esteem.
Yeah.
We also learn about the men they dated.
Yeah.
Talk more about that. How do you think their stories influence Nikki's?
Yeah, I mean, my grandmother was a poet. My white grandmother was a poet, my white Jewish grandmother. And she wrote poems and left them around the house, never to see the light of day anywhere.
Mm.
You know, my great-grandmother could sculpt and she could paint. She could play piano by ear. She could hear a song once and replicate it perfectly. But we are the only ones who know that. Out of everybody in my family, I'm the only and the first person to make any kind of a living from my art and from my creative expression. And so I don't take that lightly. The women in my family, especially my mother, sacrificed a great deal, worked incredibly hard. And that work ethic has definitely shown up for me. But that sacrifice of their own dreams, their own goals, and their own passions, like that is what, you know, when we talk about generational anything, that's a part of it. That work opened the way for me. It opened the door for me. It made it possible for me to say, you know what? I want a life as an artist, no matter how hard or under-resourced that's going to be. That's still a consideration. That's still a choice that I can make.
Just knowing that alone is enough to make it so worth having this memoir out,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how did you approach your portrayal of them in the book? And I'm curious if you had discussions in advance about what you would be including.
So no discussions in advance.
How did that go?
Not great always. At the end of the day, though, I think my family is very loving and supportive. And I make a note of saying in the beginning that I'm the most reliable, unreliable narrator you'll ever read. So I also want folks to take all of these stories, and I think any memoir, if I'm honest, take it with a grain of salt. There's no great court reporter in the sky that's writing down things exactly as they happened. And so everything I've crafted has been memory and it's been family lore. Some of it's been shaped by my perspective and my experience, certainly like by some of my own resentments and, you know, just all the things that you have about your family. But what I've tried to do, again, is pull no punches with myself. I've certainly pulled no punches with them, which isn't always like comfortable. But at the same time, like nobody wants to read a book about everything going great.
Mm.
You know,
that is true.
Yeah. So I tried to bring the best and like some of the worst to the fore.
You accompany the book with a 7-track visual EP. I want to play a little bit from one of those visual tracks. This is called Brick.
Take a brick and go at it with a hammer and chisel. Take a sliver off a terracotta colored rectangle, a chunk out of the opposite angle. Drill a hole through it, diamond shaped. Grind an edge of it into beautiful dust. Leave a footprint in it. Spit on it and make mud. Attempt to gather the slivers and bits and dust into a mold to shape it back into itself, to make it a brick, functional, worthy of construction, like it's just dying to be built into something other than itself.
For those who haven't seen this visual, Nikki, why don't you briefly describe what we're seeing as those words are being spoken and talk about what it was like packaging things this way?
Yeah, for sure. So you're seeing like literally me in my garage with a brick and chisel, you know, hammering it. I bought like a grinder to grind off parts of it. And I didn't realize because I filmed it, you know, I edited it, I put it all together. It was audio recorded and engineered by a friend of mine, Dave Marsalik from the band Spism, who's my audio engineer for the project. And then my friend Nicole Waddington, who's my like visual collaborator. But people are looking at basically a brick, pieces of it being broken off. And then the part that really got me was trying to put the brick back together.
Yes.
That was like emotionally the most difficult part of putting that video together. And I wanted to do that because I realized that during the pandemic and after the pandemic, literacy levels have really been impacted. People are just not reading as much, me included. And so I said, I need a gateway drug to this book because I want everybody to read this book. I think it's a book that's worth everyone's time and attention. And I said, how do I do that? How do I connect people to pages in a world that is largely driven by sound and video? And I said, well, we'll just make videos about the book. We'll make film trailers and we'll put it together in an album. and we'll just do that. And thankfully,
so cool.
My friends are super supportive and they're like, yeah, we'll work on that. We'll do that with you. And so they are, you know, showing up and yeah, supporting and getting this work out. But ultimately, yeah, that 7-track EP is my way of sort of translating themes of this book for folks who maybe aren't into reading right now, but still maybe need to contemplate what trauma does, how it affects us. And yeah, just the ways that were worked on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned up top, Nikki, it's Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month right now. And this year, the theme is building connected communities, which I think is right up your alley, right?
Yes.
What do you think we still need, though, in order to prevent this kind of violence and do that, build strong communities?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, especially in the past couple of years, we've seen so many celebrities be outed as predators, and we focus a lot of attention on that. We focus a lot of energy on that. Even in Chicago, we have focused a lot of attention on predators. What I would love to see is the shift to focus that attention on survivors telling their stories in their own voices, not translated through someone else, not, you know, rendered through another person's experience or perspective, but really taking that big spotlight and swinging it onto the people who've had to bear the consequences of this kind of harm. And also putting our money where our mouth is with that, resourcing survivors, paying them for their stories, paying them for their artwork, paying them, you know, to show up and to perform, centering them and not shying away from the discomfort that these narratives will bring up. But if we keep refusing to hear the stories, and if we keep making it really hard for people to tell these stories, we're never going to get to the truth, which means we're never going to get to real solutions.
Well, we've talked about how your very personal book is out and the world can see it now.
Yep.
So I got to ask, what's aftercare looking like for you?
that's a great question. You know, I think honestly, like, my aftercare is balance. You know, spending time with my 10-year-old son, Tobias, who is just the joy of my life, is really important. So Monday night, you know, the book came out Tuesday and I was very anxious Monday night. So we went to the arcade and we rode in the bumper cars and we played skee ball and air hockey and, you know, just had some fun. So that's my aftercare is just having a lot of fun and pleasure with the people I love. Yeah.
So give advice then to people who want to write. And take care of themselves in the process.
Yeah, for sure. One, take your time. Everything doesn't need, again, it took me 10 years to write this book. And I have a whole laundry list of things that happened in that 10 years that impacted me writing this book. For a long time, I actually put it away and thought it would never see the light of day. And it took a friend of mine to encourage me to keep going and to keep at it. Another thing is that if you don't feel like you're naturally a writer, that's okay, because this is not about that necessarily. So what I recommend to people, I literally told this to someone this morning, pull out your phone, open your voice notes and hit record and just talk like you would tell your stories to a friend.
So powerful.
Yeah.
That's Nikki Paten, author of Working on Me. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Congrats again. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Linnea Dominic, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. To hear more conversations like this one, head over to wbez.org/reset for a full archive of our interviews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk more soon.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely